Hello and welcome to another episode of Clientships, Customer Experience, Superheroes. This is the podcast series dedicated to unearthing the superpowers needed to be a hero in customer experience today. In this series, we've met up with a number of exceptional individuals delivering extraordinary improvements for their clients and the organisations they work with. And in today's episode, it's no exception. We meet Adrian Swinsko. Adrian is known around the globe as the CX Punk, and it's a reputation he has earned and deserves for his unsettling and relentless pursuit of improvement in customer experience. I caught up with Adrian to ask him what he feels are the real strengths you need to have to make a difference in customer experience today. So today we are chatting to Adrian Swinsko. Adrian has a formidable reputation in the customer experience industry. Anyone who's read his publications will know he has a particular way of looking at the sector, which is very healthy for those who feel comfortable in the sector. Adrian, welcome to the Clientship CX Superheroes podcast.
Hi, Christopher. How are you doing? And I'm sort of not sure I'm going to agree with that or apologize for that either. But we'll see kind of what happens, I guess.
Let's see where we go. So Adrian, you and I got to know each other a little better when you very kindly put your hand up and volunteered to give something back and make a difference when we kicked off the Customer Experience World Games. And you got involved. You actually won the damn thing as well. So that was great. But anyone who hasn't come across the games, hasn't read your book or perhaps seen your commentary out there, I know you write for a number of esteemed publications. Could you just kind of bring yourself to the table and introduce who you are, please?
Okay. So very quickly, I don't have a career. I don't describe myself as having a career. I don't describe myself as having a journey. So I started off, I trained as an economist. Please forgive me for that. I must hasten to add, I'm more sort of art than science when it comes to economics. I'm also a trained teacher, and I did both of those things, economics and teaching, here in the UK and also overseas over the course of the 90s. Flirted with becoming a professional economist, please forgive me again, but actually kind of steered away from that. Took an MBA, worked for a couple of corporates, did a bunch of things around new proposition development until about 2004. Left corporate, did a whole bunch of freelance kind of consulting kind of work. Some of it was at risk. Some of it was a little bit entrepreneurial. Nearly bought a steel company. So nearly became a steel magnate. So that's another story. And then come sort of like 2008, 2009, kind of liked the idea of operating independently, but could see kind of how the world was going as an independent, in that develop a trust at a distance, as it were. So people can get to know you through your kind of like writing. So I started writing first of all, initially about some general sort of stuff, but it got very boring very quickly. And then I figured out I needed to do something that I cared about it, or that I didn't like, or that I wanted to change. And then I figured out that actually I didn't like bad service. That doesn't make me kind of unique. It just bugs me how, having built things that have got customer value at its heart, a good service and good experience sort of at their heart, it always bugs me how organizations get in the way of their people doing a good job. And so I just started to go, as I'm a natural sort of researcher, investigator, analyst, as it were. I just started to research and write and think about it, you know, my blog. And that was, 12 or odd years ago. Then started a sort of wrote a book in a self-published anthology, or an anthology plus, or some stuff I written in 2010. Added a podcast in 2011. So I was podcasting before it was cool, still podcasting. Probably still be podcasting when it's no longer cool, because I think it's a great R&D, L&D sort of like platform. And I get to speak to some crazy people, which is that are way smarter than me, and I get to learn from them, so which is amazing. Got approached by Forbes in 2013, and we're like, we like what you're doing. You want to come and write a column for us? And I was like, yeah. Because then that gave me the kind of halo of credibility. It's like a big brand. You know, and then published another book with kind of Pearson in 2016 called How to Wow, which went on to become a bestseller on Amazon. So I'm kind of very proud of that. That ticked a lot of boxes for me. Published another book in 2019 called Punk CX, and that was basically my sort of frustration with kind of the industry is that all this activity, all this enthusiasm, all this investment, but there was a lot of stuff, not a lot of improvement. And this was my kind of way of giving it. It's full color, it's very short, it's very pithy, a la a punk sort of approach would be. And I call it a visual slap in the face for the experience industry. But throughout all that time, I have had the joy and the delight and the privilege to work with a bunch of different brands, large and small, to help them solve some of their service and experience kind of problems, you know, conduct workshops, do speaking, writing, and some advisory kind of work. And you know, we got to meet and we're involved in a couple of things and Customer Experience World Games, which, yes, my team won. I hasten to add, it was more their effort. I just helped steer the ship. They put in all the effort. I just kind of chucked a few fragile glasses across the hedge, kind of that were disguised as hand grenades every now and again to make them think, try and think a little bit differently or to hurry them along. But they did super well. Podium every time, and then overall kind of, you know, one challenge, couple of second places, couple of third places, and then overall winners. So I was so proud of them. So proud of them.
Excellent. Well, they were a great team, as were all the participants. And what we found about the games was there were people who came to the games in CX and there were people who didn't. And, you know, the people who came just gave everything they had to give because it was in their nature. So there's a couple of things that you've mentioned in that introduction. Thank you for that, Adrian, that I intentionally want to use to sort of jab at. Because I think it will kind of get you going. I mean, I think his fists are raised. I think if you want to be settled in customer experience, you've got to be restless at the moment. Adrian's book just makes you think about what you're doing and the way you're doing it and why you're doing it. And we'll come on to outcomes based, but I think it's a very good kind of manifesto for challenging the norm. But I saw something the other day that there's two parts to this. So you'll get the two parts. One is...
I need to take notes.
No, that's all right. It was Customer Satisfaction Index. I think it was the ICS one. And kind of looking back, it showed that over 20, 25 years, the needle hadn't moved. Mm-hmm. It was just the same. So my two parts are to it. One, a measure of customer experience is important. And secondly, things haven't moved on. And I'm throwing those both in as confrontational points for you to challenge me back on, knowing that you have very strong opinions on these.
Okay. So I understand kind of like metrics, but I also have a point of view where she says metrics. Because mm-hmm. Sometimes it frustrates me when we talk about service and experience and you ask people like, oh, let's talk about service and experience with your organization. And the first thing they do is trot out their scores. I'm like, I couldn't give a shit. Excuse my language to all you kind of listeners under the age of 18 or 21 or 16 or whatever it is and whichever region of the world you're listening in from. But I guess that's the point. It's like metrics are outcomes. It's a bit like if you're driving a car, right? You're driving a car 100 miles an hour along a dirt track, potholed road. You're not in good shape unless you've got this big wheeled kind of like 4x4 that's basically a favorite of people that run the Paris to Dakar rally sort of thing. So it's used to that sort of terrain. But normally 100 miles an hour on a dirt track road with full of potholes, probably not a good combination, right? Mm-hmm. So the metrics can be very relative and it's all kind of, it's very contextual. And so one of the things I find about, so that's one kind of point, is like going, sometimes it's not about other people, it's about where you're at. Because also the other point about metrics is metrics can get related to when people kind of do it, then it's like an external locus. Where you're looking for, you talk about these metrics and it's all about, I'm comparing myself to somebody else. Like, I couldn't care less. It's like, mm-hmm. ask yourself, are you proud of what you're doing? Mm-hmm. Are you absolutely proud of what you're doing? Are you absolutely nailing it? Can you be doing more? Are you satisfied with what you're kind of doing? What in you do kind of like bugs you or irritates you? To a woman and a man across the organization, 100% of the time, all of the time, if everybody goes like, we're proud. Then you're like, oh, you got it nailed. Now, contextually, if you're kind of like your satisfaction number is like, it's down here, then so what? If you're proud of it and the customers can respect you and are proud of it sort of thing, then it's all that sort of thing. It's like, it might not add up kind of like from a customer perspective, but if you're proud of what you're doing, you're trying your very, very kind of utmost, then kind of how you compare to, like, if you're in the, I don't know, the delivery of manure to farmers, that's your business. And you compare yourself to, I don't know, the Mayo Clinic or something, or the Amazon of this world, or the John Lewis's of this kind of world, I'm sort of, it's not really comparable, right? But if you're all doing a good job sort of thing, and that it, then it's all fine. And so that's the my rambling kind of point around, my problem is that people start with a number, and that's an external locus. Mm-hmm. So it starts with a number and a comparative thing. What actually I'm more interested in, are you proud of what you're doing?
Yeah.
And the other thing about the kind of the, about metrics is that people turn around metrics and you end up with the ICSI, and it's fine contextually around using it from a benchmark perspective. But I always think that benchmarks are fast track towards average. Because mm-hmm. benchmarks are around about where you are kind of like relative to your industry or other kind of like kind of people, and people, you're a bit like, if you beat the benchmark, is that okay?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm more interested in, do you just like actually forget it and go, let me figure out, pitch where you want to be, pitch what you want to kind of do, and then figure out what that gives you. And then you bring in the kind of like the benchmark or the kind of industry sort of thing, and then you understand where you compare, but don't start from the benchmark.
Someone once referred to that to me as imagine you're in a sports hall and you're in the badminton hall there with your badminton racket. How do you know how good you are at karate? Which I love, kind of, because otherwise you just, it's the herd mentality, isn't it? You kind of go, we're all a bit of a bad bunch, and I think I'm doing okay amongst this bad bunch. But you don't know you're a bad bunch, you're just a bunch, because you're just looking at a comparative group, which is far too close to who you are.
Yeah, I'm more interested in people taking a very independent look of the situation that they're in, and the people that they have, the capabilities they have at their disposal, and the customers that they kind of deal with, and actually figuring out what is the best that they can do for that particular group of people in that particular situation. Otherwise, it's this kind of thing where it's everybody's just kind of, you know, and that's one of the things I believe that is the reason behind that. The idea that we've had all this kind of different, a lot of activity, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of investment in the sort of service and experience sort of space. And yet research shows that north of 70% of major kind of programs aren't delivering on their objectives. So there's two things a number of things that might kind of explain that. One is that they're just doing the wrong things. Two is they're setting kind of the wrong expectations, or the programs are just too big. Or it's like painting by numbers, but expecting to get art. And I'm a bit like going, why didn't you try and just do something rather than try and do everything? Why don't you do something that's going to be exceptional? Mm-hmm. And just, if you do that, figure out where's your differences and do that. And that's the thing that makes you exceptional. And then you kind of double down on that and you build around kind of that. I think that's kind of that takes courage and insight and creativity and all of this, and as well as the corporate backing and the right sort of culture and environment and everything else. But there's too much, there's too much blandness out there. And that's why we're not kind of like seeing it. We're not seeing the improvement of it, because people are just looking at it going, meh, nothing's really changing. So why should I reward them with higher scores? It's okay relative to kind of everything and everybody else. There's nothing that's outstanding. And yet, what you then end up with is you end up with the players that are just doing it day in, day out. That's just part of who they are. They just do it. They haven't really changed. They just do it. And they're still up there. Like in the UK, First Direct, I've been there up in the top end, top echelons for the last sort of like 10, 15 years, whatever it is. What do? They do phone banking, for crying out loud. Mm. And what makes them good? Because they're brilliant at it. That's it.
It's straightforward, yeah.
We're like going, we're going to give you access to the kind of the, your like online banking. You can do it kind of like, do your, all your stuff, self-service over the kind of the, over the web, and probably on an app and stuff as well. But we're also going to do it over the phone. And when you get us on the phone, we are the best, most friendly, most efficient, most well-equipped, politest, respectful, blah, 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 blah. Loads of other sort of compliments type of people in the world, and we smash it. Simple. We are going to get great at, we are great at that, and we are going to continue to be great at that, and we are going to rail against the dilution of that because we believe there's value in that. And our customers keep telling us there's value in that.
And I guess when we first started, it came around, there wasn't an alternative out there. So what doesn't seem like a particularly high-risk strategy now, if you rewind it 25, 30 years, was a very high-risk strategy. To launch a bank without a branch would have just, you know, everyone else, I remember the story of, the, you know, I can't remember his name now, who headed it up when it started it, but inviting lots of the competitive banks around to show what his world looked like. And they just couldn't, thought he was mad because, you know, where are all your branches? No, this is it. this is how it's going to work here. And yet, yeah, you know, as you say, to your point, 30 years later, they're still up there. So is this because, I mean, they're not mavericks. They're not kind of just being reckless about it. I mean, they hold a banking license. They have to be very strong. But is there a danger sometimes that organizations open up the party box or the gift box of customer experience, get out their tools, lay them all down as they should be, and religiously follow their way through the path, regardless of the kind of external or internal dynamics that might be going on, such as entrepreneurial types or specialists with technology or COVID coming in, and they religiously pursue it, and unsurprisingly, the outcome, what they find is they've got a very average delivery because they've just all followed the same approach.
Yeah, so I go back to a piece of research that was released at the end of, was it 2017, 2018, something like that? And it was, at the time, it was called Dimension Data's kind of like global benchmarking sort of like study. It said, of the people that they surveyed, the organization said that they reported that they were serving their customers over 9 different channels.
Right.
And that number was set to grow to 11 over the course of the coming kind of like 18 months. Only 8% of them at the time admitted to having all of their channels connected. So there's a number of problems with kind of this. One is that the idea is that despite the fact that organizations kind of know that simplicity helps them and helps their customers and helps their employees, they keep adding kind of channels but not connecting them. So just add complexity. But they're adding complexity to an area of the business where they're not adding extra resource or investment. And so what you end up doing is you end up with this kind of like, you're asking these people who are under invested or under resourced to do more complicated things across a wider range of kind of like stuff. And we wonder why things aren't getting better. Mm-hmm. Now, things have moved on. It's probably about 2-3 years since that study kind of like was done, but we still see people trying to add and add and add and add. Right. Thing about, if you look at then this is the thing that I've always kind of thought about, but again, it takes courage. Is this idea that organizations have to decide about being great at a few rather than average at a lot. If you take some of the brands that are there, they're hiding in plain sight. Your John Lewis's of the world, your First Directs, your Amazons, your Apples, the big brands. And I'm pretty sure if you can account it up, most of them would be serving their customers over probably about 5 different channels. That's it. Mm-hmm. And so the interesting thing was everybody's going that way. They're like going, we're just going to go this way.
And that's the difference, would you say? Or is that just as contributes? Is that that kind of that thinking, that philosophy about keeping it simple, making it less complicated? Is that the trick?
I think it completely is, but it's like, it's a discipline and a commitment to it. It's relentless, right? Mm. It's almost to get to the kind of point, it's like going, it doesn't stop them adding things, but what it does do, they face this big challenge. We're like going, well, if we're going to add this, because we think that's going to be important long-term, then we have to at least eliminate one, if not 2 other channels. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're inherently going to be adding complexity to our business and diluting resources. And you think about that, and you go, your head starts to explode. You're like, oh my God, that's such a massive choice. And then you get to the point where they're going, do we need to rush to add into all these different things? Mm-hmm. Sure, we can like slow down and think a little bit. Because here's also the key, Christopher. Because we know in our heart of hearts, just people, right? We know that we will travel and pay for better service and experience, right? We know that in our kind of daily lives. It's the reason why we walk past a shop and go to another one, which is at the end of the road. Might be a little bit more expensive, but they're just slightly nicer. Mm-hmm. But the trick is we get caught up in the idea about with the travel idea, we get caught up in thinking that only applies to the physical space. Mm-hmm. But yet we will travel digitally as well as physically for better service and better experience. And so if you're operating over like a select few channels and delivering excellence through a select kind of few, people will travel to that. They just will. And so this idea that we've got to be where our customers are. Well, of course you've got to be where your customers are, but you've also got to make some choices about not being everywhere, because that doesn't serve your purpose. And it doesn't serve your customers either.
Just thinking, as you said, I've never thought about that point, Adrian. And as you say it, I'm thinking about how Direct Line do their business. You know, they don't put themselves everywhere, because they're not on every, you know, kind of airfield in the markets. They're not everywhere you go. They say, no, we don't play in that. If you want to come to us, you travel further, you find us. And actually, lo and behold, you know, they pick up all the gongs and they're seen by their customers as the most brilliant organization to deal with. And I think when I was thinking about John Lewis, I remember, and is this the right call or not? But when they put an online capability in, they reduced it down to not be seen as a sales channel. It was just in service of the stores, because otherwise there was kind of this competition building up around the digital channel versus the retail channel. I said, no. It's there in service of the stores. Sure. And therefore, digital gets no sales. And to your point there, it just simplifies things internally. So everyone internally knows how it works, as well as externally for customers. I go online because this is going to end up routing back to my local store, which is good if something needs to be collected or delivered there. I know how that works. So it's so much truism what you say there. It's a great point.
I mean, look, this is stuff that's been, the thing is, it's like this stuff has been around. There's a company in the US called REI. They're like an outdoor co-op in the US, like a national kind of outdoor retailer. Back in the 90s, they'd put their digital and their physical together. So they had a system, right, that you could go in and you can order something. And they would, rather than having this big online sort of warehouse sort of thing, they would have a system that would interrogate their store inventory. And then they would find kind of the thing that you were looking for, and they would send the order to that store. That store would kind of pack it up and dispatch it off to you. So if you didn't have it, it was like a distributed warehouse, right? But it put together, so digital and retail wasn't kind of like separate. It was like always together. That was an extensively written up way of doing things, but it was so out there at the time, 10, 15 years ahead of its time. But it's like crazy, because it networked, put these things together, didn't make them compete, it made them kind of completely work together. And yeah, it's fascinating, because a lot of people are going to get caught up in the waves of doing things. We get, there is this kind of like follow the leader type stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think the kind of the brands that persist are the ones that tend to do things their own way and are not scared to dare to be different.
Well, I think if you hold up those two points that you make around proud of what you've done, and also has it led to a better outcome, they're your measures. That's all you need to worry about, isn't it? And if you can fulfill both of those, the chances are you're pretty much going to end up in a good place.
No, absolutely. It's complete. I think it is as simple as that. If we add more to that, what we're doing is we're complicating the picture for everybody. And actually, this is, you know, the whole delivery of service or delivery of a better experience for whether it's customers or consumers or clients or patients or citizens is like a two-sided sort of thing. There are people that are delivering kind of things, and whether you want to be proud of doing a good job. And I believe that pretty much everybody wants to do a good job and be proud of what they're kind of doing. And if that is kind of, if they're enabled to do that, and that delivers great outcomes for people, then it's like, I think that's your kind of two-sided kind of equation. I don't think you can go far wrong with that.
I think you're going to make people think when they hear this podcast. If they were going to go back to their offices and kind of say, yeah, I'm going to take a bit of that bravado back with me now. I mean, what would you suggest they look at? Should they challenge something, or should they kind of lift up their own bonnet? I mean, where would you say you take this?
Take a look around and just ask yourself, what are you not proud of? Mm-hmm. What could be better? Mm-hmm. And how could it be better? But actually start from the perspective, from the metric of, or the kind of the lens of rather, what am I not proud of? And what am I proud of? If you identify the things that you're not proud of, you're like, well, ask yourself why. Mm-hmm. And then ask yourself kind of what you're proud of, and then ask yourself why. And then you're going to get this kind of, you know, you get a picture, and it start being really, really honest with yourself. Now, if you can turn around and go like, I'm not really proud of anything. You're like going, well, that's great. Don't be despondent with that. Mm-hmm. if you go like, well, I'm not really proud of anything, actually, you're like going, well, what is it going to take to make you proud of it? And start, pick one thing. What I'm going to do that's going to make you proud. What I'm going to do that's going to make you, when you get it done, you're going to literally, people are going to have to tell you to shut up to stop you telling them about it, sort of thing. I guess that's what I mean is like, it's like, I don't think there's a definitive answer to any of this, but it's driven by heart.
Yeah.
And no amount of intellect is going to drive that. Mm-hmm. And that, if when you engage that, then anything is possible.
If I'm looking at things and I believe I'm proud of them and I can see, but they're not delivering the better outcome they should be achieving. Again, I guess I shouldn't be despondent. It just means, you know, you've got to connect those two things up. That's all right. You know, you're trying to do your best here, but you're going to have to push yourself. You have to work harder.
So the first thing is going to go, are you proud of it? You're proud of it, but it's not producing the right outcomes. And you're going to ask yourself, well, why? You know, and is it because actually I can do more? Or is there something that, or you're doing something that you're proud of, but it might be the wrong thing, right?
Yeah.
Or it doesn't connect. Yeah. You're like proud of this thing and the customers are going, what?
This is the point around making sure, you know, you're aligning your resources to the areas that you can really make a difference. So, you know, just take a step back and just think, are there other parts where I can take this commitment to be proud about what I'm doing and make a real difference? It could be in the function, it could be in another company. You know, if the company is of such that you're never going to be given the permission to make it better, then maybe this is not the sort of place where your passion and your commitment for achieving betterment is going to ever be welcome or respected. You need to get out there and do it for someone else.
Here's something that I'd like to see kind of mm-hmm. more of, and this has got a completely left field kind of like point, that it speaks to all the people that are in a marketing discipline, whether they're a chief marketing officer or they're a marketing director or they're kind of they're heading up a marketing kind of department or marketing team or whatever. I would challenge them, because marketing generally has some of the biggest budgets, the biggest amount of spend available to of any kind of like function in many organizations, right? They are there to generate demand or drive demand and revenue and things. I would like to see more and more marketing teams take part of their budget and go and invest in a service initiative, because the ROI in marketing terms and in terms of customer engagement, I think is, I've seen it done a couple of times before, and the ROI is through the roof. And I'd like to see the people that have the budget go and invest in the places that need the budget but don't have it.
So this is where you need to be considering it from an enterprise perspective and from a customer's perspective. You take a step back and you say, right, we've got a finite amount of budget. Where can we get the best return? And if it happens to not be in the area you focus in on, you say, that's okay. You know, there's other things that are more worthy and more demanding of this budget. And here you go, rather than saying, well, it's my little fiefdom. And I know it's going to have a diminished return, but actually...
Well, no, it might not have a diminished return. It might be that you just go in, well, if the choice is I can run another campaign, or I can go, actually, why don't we kind of like do something kind of else, which is, why don't we contribute to a part of the business which might not necessarily be as well financed as we might be. And if we can do that, we build links and bonds and strength between different areas of the business, and that breaks down the silos and increases collaboration and understanding and all of those different sort of things, then why not?
Does this come back to a point that I know you've made before about, you know, knowing what you're in service of? Is it about recognizing, you know, what you're there to do, as opposed to, you know, you're not in service of, I don't know, the contract or the transaction? It's, you know, you're out there in service of serving the customer. So yeah. Is it about understanding that fundamental purpose? And if you don't get that from day one when you come in the organization, then is that the employee's fault? Is that the employer's fault? Or, you know, is that the customer's fault for still coming and putting up with this substandard service?
Well, you can blame the customer if you like, but I mean, I would suggest it's the individuals. It's up to the individual to decide how they want to operate. I know that probably 90% of people listening to this will discard that as an idea. It'll just kind of go boing and bounce. And then I'll go like, there'll be 9%, the other kind of 9% of people, or another 9% of people will go, huh, that's interesting. And they'll kick that around for a while. And then some of them might be successful, and some of them might kind of float the idea or whatever. Then we'll see what happens. And the remaining 1% that'll go, yeah, I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a case of, they might be sitting on a budget of like $1 million or £1 million a year as a marketing kind of budget. And they go, okay, fine. I'm going to put aside 50 grand. 50 grand budget, right? You know, as an experiment. It's not a lot. It's 5% of your budget. I'm going to put 50 grand aside. I'm going to go to speak to my... the guy who runs kind of like support or the help desk or kind of like head of customer service or whatever. And I'm going like, I've got 50 grand that I'd like to invest in customer service this year. What do you need? And they'll be like going, or he or she or they're going to be like going, oh, we could do this. Oh, we'd like to get that. We'd like to do more of that. Brilliant. Let me help you do that.
I've got an example where that would so play out, to be honest, Adrian. So this summer, for one reason or another, all quite superficial things, needing to get hold of our bank, the business bank, has been really challenging because of loans and all these sorts of things that they've been doing. And we just needed something very basic that you couldn't do online, but we needed to speak to somebody to do it. We worked out, we'd spent 17 hours trying to get hold of the bank. And I'm not joking, sometimes 2 hours waiting on the IVR system. And then when we finally got through to the person at the other end, they were very sorry, but you know, all the reasons why they couldn't do it. They were working from home. They did it very quickly and we were done. Then on reflection, we realized that we'd spent 17 minutes talking to them, 17 hours listening to a tiny bit of hold music and constantly being reminded that the reason they couldn't ask for the phone was because they were dealing with customers, of which obviously we have been one for 10 or more years. So not only did it make me feel like we weren't important to them, but I've never spent 17 hours talking to an organization in the course of a year. Just imagine if marketing, and at the same time, they're advertising on television everywhere else. Yep. Imagine if that organisation said, here's £50,000 to give to the contact centre to make that, I don't care what you do, teach them Spanish. I could learn Spanish in that time, you know. Do something to make that really uncomfortable experience more valuable to the customer. And I guess that's your point, isn't it? It's having the bravery to say, yeah, we should do that.
I remember kind of like, it was a guy by the name of Gary Vaynerchuk. I had him on the podcast ages ago, and he said an interesting thing where some of this idea comes from. He was bemoaning the fact of, he's an American guy, and he was bemoaning the fact of how much it costs for like a Super Bowl ad. And he says like cost for Super Bowl ad is probably somewhere in the region of about $3 million, like a 30-second ad, right? He said it gets you absolutely nothing. It's like a testosterone fueled nonsense. He's like, oh, we had a Super Bowl ad. Then he's like, yeah, big deal. He said, imagine if you kind of took that $3 million and say at $50,000 a piece, that's how much you would pay like a support help desk kind of person, let's say, on average, let's pick a number, right? And that would pay for like 60 additional people, or even if it was like 30 additional people over 2 years, because you budget it for 2 years. And you got them just to kind of like, as you, to your point, to man the phones so it's not 17 hours on the phones. Or to man the phones and also to proactively reach out to customers to actually kind of like to up their service and their game. And you look at that from an ROI perspective, where would you put your money?
Absolutely.
And it's a change of kind of thinking and not being, and some people are like, oh no, we can't do that. You're like, why not? If you believe in service and experience and that's important, then this is kind of sort of the things that it's going to take. Mm. Now, I also recognize there's a difference between rhetoric and activity, and there has been for the longest kind of time. Now, that over the last few months has come. We've ended up with this kind of like companies colliding with reality. I remember speaking to a CEO of a SaaS company, well-known SaaS company. He kind of turned around and said, he speaks to a whole bunch of other CEOs and like on a regular basis of other SaaS companies. One of the guys kind of admitted actually early on in the sort of pandemic, he says that, you know, that thing that we said it was important. Mm-hmm. Everything we do for customers is we put customers at the heart of our business. Well, yeah, we've been saying that, but now we really are doing it. Before it was just lip service, mm-hmm. like branding or kind of like PR or comms. And now people are starting to really, not necessarily they're not really starting to get it. They're almost like having to do it.
I was very aware of the fact that a lot of organizations got that shock that what they've always had from customers is not loyalty, it's been transactions. Mm. And when those transactions stop happening, all of a sudden that was a real test to see just how much have we invested to make our customers love us. And they kind of disappeared. I don't know if you remember in the one of the Challenges of the World Games, I was very touched by the Cat Cafe, who, when they closed down, customers were still coming by and putting £10 notes through the letterbox to just keep the thing going. Even though there was nothing coming back the other way. They were leaving cat food on the doormat and they were putting money through the letterbox. How many organisations can say that, you know, when they were not giving anything back, their customers were coming and saying, have this back from us, have this back from us. So I think you're absolutely right there. It's then you see, are we actually doing this? Are we delivering against it? There was a Spanish utility giant that just amazed me. And they made a very quick decision. In order to serve their customers, the thing that they needed to do very quickly was to secure the contracts of their suppliers, to pay them in 48 hours and not 60 days, and extend every contract out to 2022. Mm-hmm. They needed every one of their contractors to not worry, because then they would be able to deliver a great service. Yeah. And rather than spending that money in other areas, that's where they decided to invest their money that they had left over. And it's about recognizing that's in service and providing a better service, not directly to the customer or to marketing or contact center. It's in the supply chain we need to put this in. That requires quite an advanced degree of, or quite a developed understanding of the responsibility you have as an organization and where your customer is the purpose, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, but I also think it's like, you know, you have a lot of organizations that are very voice of the customer and data kind of led, but it's like their data, right? Mm-hmm. It's what customers are saying directly to them. But there's other kind of like data that's out there, like mood shift data. Yep. And data that's saying that, to your point, is that throughout this kind of like period, customers have been paying attention to how organizations are treating both their employees and their suppliers and everything else, because they want them to do the right thing. Now, there's no evidence that that's kind of shifting and that's kind of here to stay. People recognize that, you know, it's going to be tough for people, and they want companies to do the right thing. They want companies to exercise their agency, mm-hmm. you know, and all sorts of different sort of like kind of levels. And so for Iberdrola, whether they recognize, they saw the data or they recognize the mood, let's just do the right thing. And they probably didn't do it for any expectation about how it would play with kind of their customers, but they did it because it was the right thing to do. We've got to, yes, we can recognize kind of what our customers say to us, but we also have to recognize what our customers are saying kind of outside of the conversations that we're having or the feedback that we're giving us. Yeah. Because actually, let's be fair, you know, even though that the people are talking about surveying and feedbacks and voice of the customer and closing the loop and all these different sort of things, we're still dealing with low response rates. And so low response rates only give you a partial data picture. Now, it's better than nothing, but it's still a partial picture. It's like the voice of some of your customers, not the voice of your customers. It's voice of some of the customers who you catch at the right time or can be bothered. And some of those people self-select. So sometimes you need to keep listening more broadly. And that's, I don't think that's just listening kind of with your kind of ears and to date, to survey data or to social media or whatever. Actually, you need to get out into the world because your understanding of customers will in large part be driven about how much time and effort that you expend on their kind of behalf. Mm-hmm. I kind of how much time you go, how curious you are about them, how kind of much time you spend kind of like interacting with them, learning about them. You almost have to be an anthropologist of your own customers.
I think now is a very good time for organizations to take a step back and just think, how much do they know about their customers? Because if you take a great proportion of society, and it's growing, they're currently looking at their outgoings and their commitments, and they're getting there with them. They're managing to get by. So if you are, I don't know, a water company, and you've managed to reorganize the customer's repayment plan, the thing that I think organizations struggle to do is to recognize that's one of 23 outgoing commitments that customer has with other organizations every day of the month, every month of the year. And actually, whilst you might have organized it so you get your share of them, they've got another 22 of them to organize. They can't balance that all in their heads. And I think that's where organizations have a responsibility now to take a step back and say, think about our customer's world. What could we do to make that easier? Could we talk to some of these other organizations and figure out how we can do it for our customers. Yeah, that's a much stronger experience rather than just thinking about it from our perspective, put the phone down, end of. I don't know whether it's going to become mandated, but I can see us moving towards that, having a greater responsibility than you used the expression earlier. Do the right thing. You might have got the contract sorted out, but that customer's left in turmoil now. So are you proud of what you've done? Is it a better outcome? Well, for the organization, yes, but that's not the only invested, you know, the invested party at the table now. You've got to think about customers, communities, society. You've got to be more inclusive of more audiences in your decision of what a better outcome looks like.
I mean, I think that might be too far for some organizations. They just won't have the capability to do that. And I think you can probably kind of think about doing that in different kind of like different ways. But I do think there is an opportunity for many organizations to think like that. Stephen Van Balligham, in his new book, An Offer You Can't Refuse, suggests that you can go up this kind of like model and you get to the point where you become a partner in their life. Mm-hmm. And that's an idea which sort of takes retention and lifetime value and advocacy can like come to a completely different level. It's like saying, mm-hmm. we're on your side. We can't do everything, but we're on your side.
Yeah.
That will be hard for many people that are purely commercial, profit-driven organizations. They'll find it very hard to see the value in that. But they have to kind of, we have to talk, many organizations are going to have to try and tackle that. Or just kind of like going, actually be okay with, this is what we can do and this is how we're going to do it. And if we play our role in this sort of space and we do this really, really well, then we take care of this space. Mm-hmm. And everybody else has to decide what their space is. Mm-hmm. And then they go on from there. I know that my energy supplier, they, during the pandemic, because they understand the whole fuel poverty thing, they set up a fund, what they call like a customer rescue fund or something. They asked customers to, they contributed to it, so they put a bunch of money into it. Well, it's owned by its customers, so mm-hmm. we own it, as it were. Mm-hmm. It was set up with some people, but the, you know, it's on that kind of cooperative kind of yep. model in many yep. ways. So they basically took some money out of the organization and said, we understand this is a problem. It's going to be a problem for people being furloughed and things. And it's going to come back again because of we're approaching the winter. And they're like going, we're putting together this rescue fund as customers. If you want to contribute to that and contribute to the collective, as it were, to help fellow customers out that might be facing kind of problems, then yeah, knock yourself out. And I thought that was pretty neat. Because it played within their domain.
Mm-hmm. And then you think the value that has is if others look at that and say, we should do that, then that becomes the new standard. And surely that's going to be a good thing for everyone. And then all the organization that you're with thinks about how do we take this to the next level? And that's sure. where it then becomes, you know, any customer experience should, the better outcome should be everyone around the table, even competitors going, you've made us raise our standards. You've made us improve our ethics by what you're doing and the consumer yeah. benefits. And then everyone in the organization is prouder of what they've done as well.
No, exactly. They were a bit like, and the reason I wanted to go with them, one is that they're pretty competitive. Mm-hmm. That was kind of fine. But the big attractor was that they are 100% renewable and they're owned by their customers. Mm-hmm. They're also called People's Energy. Mm-hmm. Which reminded me of Citizen Smith back in the day, sort of power to the people. And also, really, really simply, is they are very simple. The mm-hmm. approach that they take is very, very simple. They're like going, we have like one, maybe two tariffs, that's it. Mm-hmm. And then they just keep adding to that. Now, if that raises people's kind of game, it's like clean energy, simple, looks after its customers by being owned by its customers, which is not a model that's necessarily for everybody, but then actually acts on that and actually does things to look after the broader concerns of its customers because it understands the context that some of them might be in. I couldn't be happier.
This brings me to my final question, which is one that is about one of the issues I see a lot of with customer experience is customer experience almost arrives and kind of goes to everyone else, don't worry, we're here to save the day. You know, the business has been creaking and rubbish. We're going to create some maps and you know what? We're going to create some wow achievements and that's it. We're here to save the day. Whereas you just made it very clear, whilst you very much value that the way they do business and the experience, actually it's the product, the price, and their reputation were part of the mix. And if this was owned by some ugly corporate who's just using, you know, the people's card as a gimmick, or the pricing was so disproportionate to what was considered to be affordable, or the product actually wasn't renewable at all, it was kind of just badged as being so, the, you know, the service experience wouldn't have accounted for anything for you. So customer experience has to respect and recognize that it's part of the team, isn't it? It's not the lead player in the team.
Well, I think the important kind of like thing, and you talk about outcomes, you mentioned outcomes earlier on, Christopher, is that, and I've said this before, is that I'm not that interested in customer experience per se. However, I am incredibly interested in the customer's experience. And I often ask kind of people the kind of the question, what's the difference between the customer's experience and customer experience? And they look at me and go kind of quizzically, and I go, well, technically, it's like four letters and an apostrophe. But in an organization, many organization realities, the difference can be a country mile. Because the customer, because the idea where we talking about customer experience, everybody starts talking about labels and functions and heroes and heroines and things about coming to fix things. And then it becomes about, as you say, maps and processes and this and that and the other. And the customer gets completely disembodied, you know, becomes disenfranchised from the whole thing, completely uncoupled from it all. And it becomes about this thing, other function, this other kind of specialism. I mean, and therefore it doesn't necessarily focus on the problem that needs to be understood, and the problem that then think about kind of what needs to be solved. So it's not about, never about the people that are in coming to sort of the new kids on the block, as it were. Mm-hmm. It's about the problem and how can we make this better.
And I think that's a really good kind of point to finish on. It's about the problem and about how can we create a better outcome that we're proud of, that we're happy to tell others about. And I like your point about, you know, almost to the point where you're told, well, you pipe down, you know, I've just had enough about how proud you are of that. But that would be a real mark for me of a quality, committed and passionate customer experience professional.
Yeah, I mean, because ultimately it's like, you know, if I were to ask people to do one thing, and it would be a case of, if somebody kind of asks you about a question, which is like, oh, tell me about customer experience in your organization, that the first thing that you do is you start by telling them a story about the last piece of kind of like heroism, you know, that you heard about, or the kind of the last catastrophe that happened and how it made you feel and what you did about it and all that sort of like stuff. Start with stories. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because if you start with stories, then you'll start to connect with it. And it's the difference between the emotional brain and the irrational kind of brain.
So stories over scores and outcomes over processes. Adrian, look, it's been an absolute delight. The listeners will realise this could go on and on and on, but you have a number of books out there. I mean, the one I would take people to is Banksy X, because it makes you feel a little restless. I think even those who've been in it for a while start to kind of just go, and actually, you know, are they in the 9% or the 1% you mentioned earlier? I bet there's a few 1%ers out there have made a change based on what they've read in your book. So,
well, here's hoping.
I'll head them there. And I guess if people want to connect with you, they can do so on LinkedIn.
Do so on LinkedIn, or, you know, check out adrianswinsko.com.
That's probably a better place to send them to the website. Get more content there, yeah?
Well, they get more content. So connect with me on LinkedIn. You can find me kind of like there. Find me on my website, and you can find my email and my, you know, even my mobile number. Just kind of like, you know what? Call me. Because I guess you what? Tell you what? I say that, and hardly anybody ever does, because they think of me as being this like super busy and kind of like monster type of guy. But I'm not. Call me.
You're a breath of fresh air and a tour de force in CX. That's very welcome. So thank you so much for giving up your time for being on our podcast, and look forward to interactions with you again in the future.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Christopher. Thank you so much for asking me.